Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the court. I'm pleased to announce that we have a bar admission ceremony this morning. And at this time, the court recognizes Colonel Pedden for a motion.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I move the admission of Angel Alfaro of the state of Texas, Mary Catherine Burney of the state of Florida, Brittany Ann Borowski of the state of Missouri, Matthew Fielding Bulo of the state of Texas, Stefano Joseph Cavallaro of the state of Florida, Kanika Chanel Hill of the state of Washington, Eric Maringel of the state of California, Kimberly D. Martinez of the state of California, Robert Charles Pyatt of the state of Missouri, Andrew Edward Self of the state of Tennessee, and Dennis T. Scanlon of the state of New York. I have examined their credentials on file in the office of the clerk, and I am satisfied they possess the qualifications for membership in the bar of the court.
Thank you, Colonel Pedden. Counsel, my colleagues and I have conferred, and we are convinced of your integrity and your legal acumen. Accordingly, we voted unanimously to admit you to the bar of this court. Therefore, Colonel Pedden, your motion is granted. Mr. Squires, please administer the oath. Counsel, I'd like to welcome you to the bar of the court. In doing so, I believe it's appropriate for me to recite the words that are engraved over the entrance to the University of Virginia School of Law. Those aspirational words are as follows: that those alone may be servants of the law who labor with learning, courage, and devotion to preserve liberty and promote justice. Because all of you exemplify those ideals, it is a pleasure indeed to welcome you to the bar of this court. Congratulations. You may be seated. Mr. Squires, do you have any other business before the court before we proceed to oral argument? Very well, then. We have one case today, United States versus Grijalva. Lieutenant Milham, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
Lieutenant Ulan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Skyler Milham, and I represent the appellant, MK3 Mark Grijalva. Chief Judge Olson, I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
And counsel, could you get closer to the mic, please? Thank you.
Yes, sir. In this case, the government believed it could not prove appellant's conduct violated the military nexus element of Article 117 Alpha. So it subtracted that element and instead used the remainder of Article 117 Alpha's elements to charge him under Article 134 with service discrediting conduct. But that is exactly what the preemption doctrine prohibits. And so therefore, this court should set aside the findings for two reasons. First, Congress intended Article 117 Alpha to occupy the field of wrongful broadcasting of intimate visual images that were taken with consent. But this was done so in the broadest legally way possible. And then second, the charged offense consists of a residuum of elements of Article 117 Alpha.
So, counsel, in regard to the first prong, we've got cases like Anderson that seem to indicate from our own precedents that this court is required to consider legislative history. So it's not just a situation where the precedents say you can look at either legislative history or the statutory language and determine whether Congress intended to occupy the field. But then, as noted in footnote 8 in Avery, We've got a Supreme Court case from just 5 years ago where the Supreme Court said that using legislative history to determine legislative intent is, quote, a relic from a bygone era of statutory construction, end quote. So it seems as if we have our own precedent that says we need to consider, are required to consider, legislative history. And on the other hand, we have the Supreme Court fairly recently saying that that approach is not valid, it's not sound. How do we square that circle?
Your Honor, this court should consider the legislative history, but it also shall consider the plain language of the statute.
Okay, but I'm asking specifically, how do we reconcile those two different positions? This court saying, must consider legislative history. Supreme Court seems to be saying, don't consider legislative history when deciding legal issues.
Yes, Your Honor. So to the extent that the Supreme Court does not want or has set the precedent that legislative history is no longer a criteria that courts shall look to in determining cases, at least with respect to this case, while the legislative history is indeed helpful, appellant would assert that the strongest position in determining whether or not the offense was preempted would actually be within the plain language of the text itself. So in terms of squaring it with what the Supreme Court has established in its own precedent, I think it would make sense for the court to consider legislative history as just informational background, as detail, but in terms of winning on the case of legislative history, no, I think there has been enough precedent to say that this court and Supreme Court have considered plain language, comparing statutes to one another, and additionally reviewing the legislative history of certain statutes as they're being revised.
So I want to make sure I understand your position. Is legislative history standing alone not dispositive of the preemption doctrine in your view?
According to the Supreme Court, no, Your Honor. And I would go so far to say that the legislative history in this case, while it is helpful, is not critical in this court's analysis. So I would firmly assert that the preemption issue would fall squarely within just the plain language of this text.
Counsel, I just want to make sure. I want to ask you a little more directly what I think the Chief is getting at. Is it your position that the requirement that this court, from our precedent, that we look at legislative history to determine congressional intent, should we abandon that requirement? Is it no longer good law in light of the evolution of Supreme Court precedent on how we determine congressional intent? Is congressional intent, should we, in a post-Blockberger world, where when courts compare one offense to another offense and they just compare elements, is there any relevance anymore to the prong of our precedent that says we need to not just compare the offenses, but also try and determine through legislative history what the congressional intent was? Should we abandon that precedent?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think in this case that would be fair to do, just based on the Supreme Court's ruling, as Chief Judge Olson had indicated earlier.
So Counsel, before you get back into it, I just want to be clear. Is it your argument that 117 occupies the field completely, that any offense involving images that are distributed, that were taken consensually but distributed non-consensually, falls under 117-alpha?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. That said, then, how do we account for the fact that there's that age cutoff in 117A? And so minor photos taken of a minor, even consensually, and we'll set aside whether a minor can give consent, would not fall under 117A by the plain text of the legislation.
Yes, Your Honor, and by the plain text, it is clear that Congress identified that it is adults that are to be protected from the offenses done related to Article 117-alpha.
Okay, so wouldn't a more accurate, your more, not to make your argument, but wouldn't your more accurate statement be that, you know, the scope is actually narrower? It's not occupied the field writ large. It's occupied the field based upon the parameters that are set forth in 117 alpha.
It is, yes, Your Honor. It is occupied parameters within the offense that it is clearly laid out in the text itself.
Okay.
And so, referring to the plain text.
Counsel, can you just bring the microphone more towards you?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry. My apologies.
If you move the microphone, it would be more helpful. Yes.
With regards to the first element of the offense, it identifies the criteria of who qualifies for the protection of the statute. The language that is intentionally included is another person, a person. And that language is quite broad. There's no ambiguity. And we can understand that because there's no definition of what a person is to mean in this context, if there is any ambiguity with respect to who is to be protected under this statute, Congress has clearly laid out that courts, or anyone really, to look to Title I of the U.S. Code under Section 1, where it provides a clear definition of who qualifies, and that is another individual. A person means another individual. And so from that context, we know that the statute was intentionally written to be quite broad. And as Congress is developing even this particular statute, this court has, in prior precedent, leaned on the assumption that Congress knows of existing law as it is legislating new acts. And in addition, any words or omissions of words are done with intent and purposely. And we know this from looking at other offenses in the U.S. Uniform Code, Articles 89 through 92, where they specifically identify who is to be covered as protection under that particular statute. For example, military officers, warrant officers, enlisted members. And this criteria, as we proceed into the sub-elements of the first element, provide the only criteria, really, on who is to be met as a victim. They have to be 18 years or older. They have to be an adult. They have to have not consented to the distribution or the broadcasting of the image. And they also have to be identifiable. Congress could have very easily included the language that this be an offense that is only applicable to service members. They could have included the language similar to 89 through 90 that it is service members, enlisted members, anyone within active duty or even a veteran to be protected. And absent that language, the plain text of the statute, the simple reading of that language, indicates and should provide to this court that the language was quite broad and that it's all-encompassing. And so as we proceed on through the text of the statute itself, the other element, particularly at issue here, is the fourth element, the military nexus element. And every word, every element that is in a particular statute must be given meaning. It must have a particular effect to what it is to accomplish. And in this element of Article 117 Alpha, we know that the conduct is what the military nexus element is to be applied to, not the victim-centered position that the lower court has taken and the position that the government has taken as well. And, you know, assuming if the lower court is correct in that 117 Alpha is not broad and that it's going to only apply to service members and others with the military nexus, it would essentially violate the doctrine of surplusage, because by having included any language that would apply strictly to service members, the fourth element would otherwise be superfluous. Because if there's a military member, service member, that is automatically going to satisfy the fourth element.
Lieutenant, may I ask you a question? Would you agree that the burden is on you to demonstrate clearly that what the intent of Congress was here?
Yes, sir.
So you're doing an admirable job of weaving together all of these points. But at the end of the day, how do you distill this down to have us think not through a legalistic interpretation of A equals B, B equals C, C equals D, therefore A equals D, but looking at this language, it was Congress's intent to occupy the field.
Yes, Your Honor. And so where we get to congressional intent is by looking at the evolution of the statute. So we begin with the initial bill that was provided by Congress, which fell under the Private Act. And the proposed language under Article 117 Alpha only included three elements. And it's the same three elements that are provided in the statute today. And so from that point on, we know from the broad language of who it is to who the offense is to protect is to be broad and that it encompasses everyone. And with the understanding that over time, the evolution of the statute developed in such a way that the fourth element was included, we know from the plain language of the text that from that point on, if assuming the lower court is correct in that the first element is only applied to service members, the fourth element would be surplusage. And so there's the understanding of that dichotomy between the first element and the last element that provides context to what Congress intended in doing by establishing this additional element. And
but, counsel, you seem to be now saying that this court should look to the legislative history to take away that final element. As Justice Kagan said, we're all textualists now. We're looking at the text. At the beginning of your argument, you said legislative history really isn't a valid approach. Now you seem to be saying, look at legislative history to decide what was meant here. Why are we, this court, not bound by the plain language that's before us with no regard whatsoever about how that last element came about, when it came about, who proposed it? Why is any of that relevant?
It is relevant, Your Honor, in, as I mentioned earlier in addressing your first question, that while it has been established that looking at legislative history is kind of an older age form of interpreting statutes and understanding whether or not preemption applies, it is, like I said earlier, important details to understand why certain elements were included.
And but why? Why? You seem to be indicating that we should excise. This court should say we are going to ignore something that is in the plain language of a statute. What's our basis for doing that?
Yes, Your Honor. And so with respect to the fourth element, we understand that that exact language, that there be a direct, reasonably direct and palpable connection to a military mission, military environment, that is the precise language that was referenced in this court's opinion in Wilcox. And understanding that opinion from Wilcox, we understand that it's generally applied in offenses that revolve around First Amendment issues. Now, while this court doesn't have to address or even answer the First Amendment issue in this particular case, we just need to understand what Congress's intent was. By looking at the language of the element on its face, we know that that particular language is to apply to First Amendment issues, and given the First Amendment issue in this context, that there may be certain images that are protected from that are protected under the First Amendment with regards to free speech, the final element is provided in here to ensure that the government provides some sort of evidence, and they must provide this evidence, that there is a military connection, that there's some military nexus. And this court has looked to, has opined in Heiser, where it has indicated that by simply sending an image to another service member, that enough alone would suffice this particular element. And so by looking
at... Well, counsel, I don't think there's any real mystery why DOJ had Congress put that element in, right? I mean, it's based straight out of Wilcox. In Wilcox, this court said that it doesn't matter whether it's charged under Article 134, Clause 1 or Article 134, Clause 2. It doesn't make any difference. If there's a First Amendment issue, then it says, we conclude that a direct and palpable connection between speech and the military mission or military environment is also required for an Article 134 offense charged under a services crediting theory. So it doesn't matter, right? This court in Wilcox said, if you want to convict someone of an Article 134 Clause 1 or Clause 2 offense, you must prove this connection. So someone clever at DOJ read Wilcox, and they saw that, and they let Congress know, hey, your draft Article 117A is unconstitutional unless you do this, or at least it won't get past CAF. And so they put it in, right? Like, there's no real mystery why it's in there. The question is, really, I think, before this court, is how can the government just drop that element and charge it under 134 anyway?
Because that's exactly what the preemption doctrine provides, Your Honor. And the government has been, the government understands that it can't simply just drop an element to erase its evidentiary proof. It must still establish these elements. And at the end of the day, the government was still going to have to prove that there is a military nexus because, per Wilcox, Your Honor, I see that my time is due to expire. If I can continue to answer the question.
Please just continue to answer the question no further.
Wilcox provides that even in the context of 134, if it regards to a First Amendment issue, the government can charge it as a service discrediting if it isn't already subsumed by the field, but it still has to prove that service military nexus element.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant. Lieutenant Millen?
Your water bottle.
Lieutenant Millen. Lieutenant?
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson and judges of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Elizabeth Yulin, and with Mr. John Nolan, we represent the United States. This court should affirm appellant's conviction as Article 117 Alpha does not preempt the Article 134 offense charged in Specification 2 of Charge 3 for three reasons.
Counsel, you also need to speak up.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or stay closer to the mic. Thank you. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to throw you off.
No, it's okay. Thank you, Your Honor. Article 117 Alpha statutory language shows that it's tailored specifically to address the non-consensual sharing of intimate visual images of adults when there is a military nexus. At least two gaps exist, as the statute does not apply to minors.
So,
or
I mean, we already Wilcox requires a military nexus either way, right? So that's off the table. All right, how does that differentiate it, 117A from 134? Given Wilcox?
Your Honor, in Wilcox, the case specifically was looking at protection of speech and...
Are you saying there's no First Amendment issues here?
No, Your Honor.
All right, so we're in a world where the government's charging someone for an offense that has First Amendment issues involved. Therefore, we're in the Wilcox world, and you have to prove a direct and palpable connection either way, right? Doesn't matter whether you charge it under Clause 1 or Clause 2. Wilcox says it's got to be proven, right? So there's no difference because Congress put that element into 117A, and it's already in 134, so it's the same, right?
Your Honor, the government here obviously didn't brief specifically on whether or not the conduct constituted protected speech, as the issue wasn't raised by appellant or briefed at the CCA. We can, however, provide specific supplemental briefing on that issue.
Are you debating that revenge porn laws, generally speaking, have First Amendment connotations, and that's why several states, similar provisions have been struck down as unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor. The states have specifically looked at whether or not there are constitutional issues with revenge porn statutes specifically, which has worked its way up through the state system. Dependent on specifics of the statute, though, the states have looked a little differently.
Right. So we can debate whether or not the First Amendment, well, the strength of the First Amendment arguments, but there are First Amendment arguments involved. Is that fair?
There are First Amendment concerns. Yes.
So does the government, does the government concede that what the government did in this instance is they took 117A, and they dropped two elements, and they charged it as a novel 134 offense? Is that exactly what happened here?
Your Honor, facially looking at the elements.
Yeah, let's just look at the elements, because after Blackburger, that's how we do it. So, is that what happened in this case? Did the government take 117A, drop two of the elements, and then charge it as a novel 134 offense?
Your Honor, the government didn't charge under 117 Alpha because of the facts of this case.
I don't care why they didn't. I want to know if that's what happened. Did the government take a statutory offense, drop two elements, and then charge it as a novel 134 offense?
By strictly comparing the elements, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So, without referencing the preemption doctrine, I want you to explain to me in just general terms, how does that comport with just general notions of due process?
Your Honor, based off of the facts of this case here, the military...
Just generally speaking, if you were going to explain to someone why it's okay under general notions of due process and fairness for the government to take a statutory offense created by Congress, drop elements from it, and then charge it as a novel 134 offense, why is that okay?
Your Honor, specifically in this case, based off of what the appellant did here, which was providing...
So the appellant's a bad guy. Great. I still want to answer my question. Generally speaking, you want a rule that it's okay for the government to take a statutory offense created by Congress, drop elements from it, and charge it as an Article 134 offense, right? The government wants that authority. It's arguing it has that authority. How does that comport with due process?
Your Honor, the government would argue that generally we're not saying that that should be the case, but specific to on a case-by-case basis, depending on what the facts are, that in this case, that was okay.
All right. Well, let's look at Article 134, right? The opening language of Article 34 says, though not specifically mentioned in this chapter, then all disorders and neglects can be charged under Article 134. How is this conduct not conduct specifically mentioned in the chapter, given the existence of Article 117A?
Your Honor, it's not specifically, as there was no direct or palpable connection based off of that last element to a military mission or environment. However, it was still a service discrediting.
Wait, so now you're conceding that there was no direct, doesn't that make the offense legally insufficient under Wilcox?
No, Your Honor, specifically as to Wilcox, the government's position is that was a traditional speech case.
So now we have traditional speech cases and just kind of speech cases.
Yes, Your Honor. And so in this instance where the speech at issue is a form of non-consensual distribution of intimate images, especially in situations where the appellant pretends to be the victim when distributing these images.
So the First Amendment doesn't apply to distasteful speech that we don't like.
In situations where the appellant does pose as the individual as they're setting that out, no, Your Honor, that should not be protected.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I want to go back to something that you just said, that with regards to the fourth element and that there was no direct or palpable nexus. I think the record supports the fact that one of the recipients of the images was, in fact, a service member. And under Heiser, that was sufficient to prove the fourth element. And so why is that not operative in this case?
Your Honor, it's not operative in this case. There was one of the individuals that received the photos was in the Navy. However, at the time that the appellant sent the photos, that individual believed that the appellant was the victim that he was communicating. He didn't know he was communicating with a service member. All of those communications occurred privately in a civilian setting via text message or on the dating app. There was no tie back to the military environment outside of what occurred there.
Okay, so government's advocating, obviously, then a victim-centric approach as opposed to a conduct-centric approach as to how we're to interpret this statute? I mean, the language of the statute is it points to the conduct of the sender, the person who's distributing the – so what the recipient knows or doesn't know, what is the support for that position?
Your Honor, the government is arguing that it's just a victim-centric approach, but that all of the facts that go into it should all be assessed to determine whether or not there is a proper military nexus. And here, all of the conduct occurred in a civilian setting away from the military. The individuals who were provided the photos weren't aware that they were communicating with a military member at all. The military didn't come into the process until the investigative stage. So in light of all of that conduct occurring, not within a military setting, not having a military victim, that this case wouldn't fall under 117 Alpha. First, going to my second point, there are at least two gaps with this statute, as Article 117 Alpha shows that Congress did not cover this offense in a complete way. Specifically, Article 117 Alpha doesn't apply to minors under the age of 18 or when there is a civilian victim and the conduct occurs in a solely civilian setting.
Counsel, I have a further question. So let's just assume that we can get past the Article 134, the statutory hurdle, that this is not conduct specifically mentioned in this chapter already. Let's go to what the President tells us then. So Congress has spoken, and they've said that seems to create a preemption doctrine. And then the President says in the manual, the preemption doctrine prohibits application of Article 134 to conduct covered by Articles 80 through 132. So, and then he goes on to explain, Article 134 cannot be used to create a new kind of offense, one without an element. So, like, why isn't this a direct violation of what the President has ordered the field to do with respect to preemption?
Your Honor, it's not a direct violation because under the facts of this case, 117 Alpha didn't cover this specific misconduct that appellant.
So you're saying the appellant could not have been charged under 117A?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then why is that?
In this case, there was not a direct or palpable military nexus to a mission or
So it's the government position any time it can't prove one of the elements of one of the statutory offenses, then it's just free to charge it as a Article 134 novel offense?
No, Your Honor. The government's position is, in this case, under the preemption doctrine, which looks at what Congress intended that from...
If we want to go to the preemption doctrine, then like, where does that come from? I know you're going to say it's my own precedent, but I didn't write it. So where does that requirement, what is the basis or the justification for a requirement that before, instead of just comparing the elements of the offenses, we go and we try and decipher the intent of Congress?
Yes, Your Honor. So that comes from the court's case law, which the court has continued to follow even.
Right. I totally agree with you. We've said it over and over and over again since the 1950s. But if you trace, I've traced back in all those cases, I can't find that the court ever cited anything. No statutory basis, no constitutional basis. There's no basis for it. They just made it up, right? And what's interesting about that, at least to me, is in 1952, the Supreme Court had articulated exactly the opposite rule, right? So there, they're comparing two criminal statutes, and they're doing it for the purpose of sentencing, but they're still answering the same question, are these the same offense or are they not? And they say that they were, because of double jeopardy concerns and the rule of lenity, they're going to say, they're going to require that Congress should have spoken in language that is clear and definite that they are not the same offense before they will assume that they are. And that has been the consistent rule at least since 1952. And then you get all the way to Blockberger, and then they say, now we have a new rule. Now, if you want to know if two things are the same offense, you compare the elements. But even post-Blockberger, they continue and they say, to the extent there's any ambiguity when you compare the elements, since they don't always line up perfectly, they reapply their clear statement rule. Congress must clearly state that two offenses are different offenses, or the presumption is that they're not. So in light of that existing Supreme Court precedent, how do we justify a presumption that there is no preemption when the Supreme Court is telling us to do exactly the opposite, and in fact the President is telling us to do exactly the opposite?
Your Honor, although the government's position is that the court should follow its current precedent to look at legislative history, but regardless of looking at that, even looking at the specific statute itself, the language of it shows that Congress meant for it to be used towards very specific conduct where an individual is under 18 and there is a specific direct and palpable connection to the military environment. But when comparing the statute to Article 120 Charlie, which also combats similar misconduct, the difference being whether or not the picture was taken with consent, Congress didn't include either of those elements there, showing that 120 Charlie is a lot broader than what 117 Alpha is.
So it's still the government's position that it is appropriate for this court before we, even if we line up the elements and we think something is essentially a lesser included offense of a statutory offense, we still should go and comb through the legislative history before we apply a preemption doctrine.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we'd have to do that for any offense, all the statutory offenses, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you explain to me, do you know, having prepped for this case, which statutory offenses are preempted and can't be charged under Article 134 and which ones can?
Not specifically off the top of my head, no, Your Honor.
Right. And you've been to law school, and you've been to the Naval Justice School, right? And you are a valued member of the Government Appellate Division, right? You should know as well as anybody. So I guess what I'm wondering is, how can we have a test that requires people to comb through legislative history, which is something the Supreme Court's already told us not to do, in order to figure out what the law is and what is a crime and what is not? If you don't know, and I didn't expect you to know, I don't know, how can we expect an E1 18-year-old service member to know what is criminal and what is not criminal if the answer to that question requires parsing through the legislative history and picking your friends out of the crowd and trying to justify whether or not Congress intended the offense to be preempted or not?
Your Honor, based on this specific facts and what occurred here, the appellant's conduct was service discrediting, and as you said, Your Honor, an E4 should know that they shouldn't hack into someone's Snapchat.
Right. And he got charged with a bunch of crimes, and he got convicted of a bunch of crimes.
Yes,
right?
Sir.
That's not the question. The question isn't whether or not he's a good guy, whether or not he should have known. The question is, should he have known that the government can take a statutory offense, drop two elements, is what we already conceded the government did, and then charge it as a novel Article 134 offense. Given the incredibly broad and vague and unique nature of Article 134, I'll get back to my very first question. Why should this court allow that?
Your Honor, specifically to this case, the government's not arguing that should be allowed in every instance, but
then what should the rule be?
Your Honor, the government's position is that when there is a specific intent by Congress, by either looking at the statutory language or looking through legislative history, for Congress to occupy that field, then 134 should not be charged.
So, I mean, the government's answer is just keep applying this preemption doctrine, which has no basis in statute or in the Constitution and is contradicted by what the President directs us to do in the manual, and is also contradicted apparently by the text of Article 134. Nevertheless, it's the government's position that we should just keep on trucking with this preemption doctrine that requires us to go do something which the Supreme Court tells us not to do, which is go comb through the legislative history to figure out what the law is.
In this instance, yes, Your Honor.
So, Lieutenant Ulan, may I ask you a question? If prior to the passage of 117A, so 117A isn't in anybody's mind at that point, could this offense under Article 134 have been charged, and could this appellant have been convicted under a 134 offense for what he did?
It's the government's position that, yes, he could have been.
And what implication does that have, then, in terms of taking away a couple of elements and so forth, in terms of the government's argument?
Your Honor, can you repeat your question one more time?
Certainly. So you're saying the accused in this case still could have been charged even prior to 117A being created, passed by Congress. So much of this discussion has been outside of the four corners of the preemption doctrine, talking about fair notice. Would an E1 have fair notice at that time, prior to 117A, that this conduct was criminally actionable by the government?
Yes, Your Honor. In United States v. Vaughn, this court said that for fair notice purposes, that state law or other federal laws and cases can be looked at to determine if there's proper fair notice. In this case, prior to the enactment of 117 Alpha, there were state statutes that covered this type of offense, specifically revenge porn statutes, which would have provided the appellant fair notice that his crime was punishable under Article 134.
But then what about after the Congress? So Congress acts, they create a statutory offense. What, if anything, should that matter? Does it matter at all? I agree with you. This conduct would have been, you know, chargeable under 134 before the enactment of Article 117A. But then it's enacted. Does that have any – when Congress creates a statutory offense, does that have any meaning? Or really, are the statutory offenses created by Congress, are they just sort of irrelevant in that we can still just drop an element and charge it under 134 if we want to? We'll just go – why not? Like, we'll just go back to the good old days of the Articles of War. We'll just ignore the statutory offenses. We'll just charge everything under the general article.
Your Honor, I see my time is almost up. May I answer the question?
Please do.
Your Honor, the government's position, the statutes, the UCMJ articles do matter that Congress enacted. However, when Congress doesn't completely occupy the field for that specific offense, that allows when the conduct is service discrediting or against good order and discipline for the government to charge under Article 134.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Lieutenant Ulan.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Milham, you have 2 minutes.
The facts in this case are quite clear. MK3 Grijalva broadcasted this image that involved a civilian victim. She was 18 years or older. She did not consent to the broadcast, and excuse me, she was identifiable. She had a reasonable expectation of privacy. Arguably, she indicated on trial that she was harmed and that there was a military nexus in this case because one of the recipients received the image was in the Navy. And particularly what's daunting in this case is back in 2019, when this investigation came about, the government agents knew that this conduct did involve another military member. And then 2 years later, despite not having yet preferred the charges, that's when they decided to do so, but not under 117 Alpha, under Article 134.
And with respect to looking at content that is not the legislative history of this case, this court can also look to what the Air Force ruled in Jones. The court ruled that a civilian victim in that case can be used or can be applied to Article 117 Alpha. And so ultimately what we have here is a textbook case of preemption. The government subtracted two elements from Article 134, or 117 Alpha, excuse me, and then applied it to 134 for service discretion. If preemption isn't going to apply to that case, where else would it then apply? Because Congress occupied this particular field of unlawful broadcasts of images that were taken with the consent.
Any questions from the bench? Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
Court is adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.